You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the February 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of The Other Harvey Scandal by William D. Cohen. That still was not the end of the saga. Soon after AMFAR's February 2016 gala honoring Weinstein, a special committee of the AMFAR board hired Tom Ajami, a respected litigator with practices in New York and Houston, to investigate the Weinstein transactions. In his September 2016 report, Ajami recounted 14 unsuccessful attempts to speak with Weinstein. He concluded that the transaction exposed AMFAR to material risk to its financial integrity and reputation, and that because Weinstein refused to disclose any of the material facts about it, AMFAR had no way of determining whether there was any danger of being involved in an illegal, fraudulent, or misleading transaction. Weinstein's attorney, Benjamin Braffman, counters, "Mr. Weinstein has helped to raise north of $50 million for AIDS research. To suggest that he would use, or did use, AMFAR for an illegal purpose is not true, and under the circumstances, offensive. We believe the facts, without question, establish that Mr. Weinstein has at all times acted with unwavering dedication to the AMFAR cause from its inception. It has been clearly demonstrated that at no time did Mr. Weinstein engage in any wrongdoing as it related to AMFAR or ART. Mr. Weinstein also at no time took or received any charitable deduction from or as a result of his Neverland investment. For its part, ART declined to comment about its deal with Weinstein and his investors. An ART spokeswoman emailed Vanity Fair saying only that it was aware of the federal investigation. We are not the target, but of course we are cooperating fully. Instead of helping to clarify what Weinstein had imposed on AMFAR, Ajami's report exacerbated a rift on AMFAR's 19-person board between those who supported coal and those who didn't. Apparently, it was a Cold War that had been brewing for some time. On September 28th, one of Cole's allies on the board wrote a blistering two-page letter to fellow board members, claiming that the chairman had just wanted to preserve AMFAR's relationship with Weinstein. This is the hand that leaders sometimes are dealt, under pressure, with long-term supporters demanding immediate resolution. What would any of us have done? In a September 30, 2016 executive session, the board concluded that Ajami's report was factual, but Cole disagreed. He countered that the investigation was a complete waste of time and that he was angry and offended by how Ajami had treated him in interviews for the report, according to Yashar Ali, writing in the Huffington Post. The board then voted to prevent Ajami from delivering his report in person. "There was no reason to at least not hear me out for 10 minutes, Ajami says. A source close to events says Cole and his allies were strong objectors to having Ajami address the board. "The whole thing was driven because Harvey's angry, Harvey's angry, Harvey's angry." "Harvey had nothing to do with this," says Cole. "The majority of the board saw no value in a presentation." The source also said that Harvey was especially angry at Ajami, whom he accused of spreading false rumors about sexual harassment and rape. Weinstein has denied all allegations of non-consensual sex. Ajami concedes that over the course of his 7-month investigation of the relationship between Weinstein and Amphar, he heard such rumors, but he denies ever having pursued them. He says he did approach his friend, Los Angeles attorney Lisa Bloom, who, like her mother, Gloria Allred, has a legal practice focusing on representing women making claims of sexual harassment, to inquire whether she might be interested in representing some of Weinstein's accusers. Later, Ajami learned, much to his surprise, that Weinstein had hired Bloom to advise him on gender and power dynamics, according to the New York Times. Bloom no longer works for Weinstein and declined comment for this story. After the Amphar board received Ajami's written report, an increasingly worried Weinstein secretly hired Black Cube, the private intelligence agency filled with ex-Mossad agents, to investigate the Amphar board members, according to several sources. He wanted to know if any of them were leaking information about his alleged sexual misdeeds to Ajami. On October 17th, Cole called an emergency Amphar board telephone meeting to share the news that Weinstein was threatening to sue Amphar for spreading false allegations about him. "How dare you, after 25 years, tens of millions I've raised, all I've done for Amphar, how dare you stick your lawyers on me to do what they're doing?" Weinstein said, according to the minutes of the board's telephone meeting. Weinstein threatened to personally investigate each person on the Amphar board and the committee. To placate Weinstein, over the objection of several board members, the Amphar board hired Oren Snyder, a partner at Gibson Dunn, to reinvestigate Weinstein's deal with ART. But it turned out that Snyder had also been one of Weinstein's attorneys over the years. How could the Amphar board have agreed to hire Snyder to investigate Weinstein when he was also working for Weinstein? Some people said, "Don't you know Gibson Dunn had a conflict with Harvey?" says someone familiar with what happened. The truth is, that was a benefit, because we weren't at odds with Harvey. He was our biggest fundraiser. We just wanted to know if anything that happened between either side was illegal. If Harvey effed up and did anything wrong, then we needed to fix it. That was our goal, not to put him on trial. The majority of the Amphar board phoned into a January 31st meeting with Gibson Dunn, at which Snyder shared his findings. Amphar had done nothing wrong in its dealings with Weinstein, he said. As Snyder now puts it, it speaks more to the bad internal practices of the organization than a crime being committed. After investigating all sides of the transaction, they gave us a letter stating that what was done was neither illegal or unethical, says Cole, who added that Snyder told the board that Ajami had acted outside the scope of his mandate by looking into Harvey's personal life. Ajami denies doing so. But Weinstein was still not happy. In February 2017, he threatened to sue the Amphar board members personally unless each signed an extraordinary non-disclosure agreement, acknowledging that Gibson Dunn had informed the board that it found no evidence of improper conduct. Furthermore, he wanted each board member to represent and warrant that he or she had not at any time in the past and will not at any time in the future assist or conduct or help any investigation, review, or inquiry of any kind relating to Mr. Weinstein, including but not limited to his personal and business activities. On February 17th, Amphar Board Treasurer John Simons emailed his fellow board members strongly urging them to sign the NDA in order to avoid being sued by Weinstein, according to a timeline of events sent to the New York State Attorney General. Cole also urged the board members to sign by casting the terms of the NDA as less draconian than they were. In the end, Cole wrote to the board, we are signing something that promises confidentiality and that we won't involve ourselves in Harvey's affairs in the future. Cole claims that Weinstein told him that if everyone signed the NDAs, he would give Amphar another $1 million. When I said to Cole that this sounded like a bribe, he replied that concerns about Harvey's personal life were overruled by the promise of $1 million. He had concluded that signing the NDA would help put this matter behind us. In the end, 11 Amphar board members signed the NDA. 5 refused to sign. Another 2 signed, but then thought better of it and tried to take back their signed documents. Since January 2017, 6 board members have resigned, and 2 have hired their own attorney to handle the inquiries by federal prosecutors. Another 4 have become dissidents. They have not resigned, but have hired an attorney who has written letters to the New York State Attorney General sharing their concerns about Weinstein's gambit and other board issues. Recently, 4 new people, including Harry Belafonte and Eileen Getty, have joined the board. Cold as charity. In January 2017, a few months after he had issued his report to Amphar, Ajami went to the Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah, where Weinstein has for years been a hugely important figure, and where Cole is on the board. While there, he saw Lisa Bloom, whose book Suspicion Nation would soon be optioned for the movies by Harvey Weinstein. Bloom pleaded with me, Ajami says, to go see Harvey in his hotel suite. I wrote a report, Ajami tells me. I had been told that he's unhappy with it. So I decided that I will hear him out. I'm a big boy. I will go listen to his point of view. At their meeting, Weinstein melted down for 2 hours, Ajami continues, alternating between accusing me for all his life's problems and then talking to me about his films and Academy Awards and why he has sex with thousands of women and how he can make anyone a star, how there's a conspiracy against him. He's a very strange dude. He said that Weinstein also told him Rose McGowan is a crazy person and threatened him, you're not so clean either, Tom. I have investigated you, and you had better watch out. For the next few months, Ajami says, Weinstein and Amphar kept pushing him to sign the NDA. Weinstein was now threatening to take away his support for the 2017 Cannes Gala. The pressure on Ajami from Weinstein to sign the NDA was growing exponentially, but he still refused. He hoped to calm Harvey down with a compromise. If Weinstein would go to the Cannes Gala with his posse. Among them, Blavatnik, Leo DiCaprio, Uma Thurman, and Robert De Niro, Ajami would not pursue any investigation into his personal life, which he says he wasn't doing anyway, but Harvey thought he was. Braffman says that at no time did Weinstein threaten to sue or investigate board members, or threaten to withhold support for the charity. Ajami says he got on the phone with Weinstein, who kept pressing for him to sign. Lynn Blavatnik and Leo DiCaprio are waiting for your decision on whether they are going to attend or not, Weinstein said, according to Ajami. It's all on your shoulders right now. Weinstein's attorney, David Boyce, wants you to sign the non-disclosure agreement, so you need to do that. Ajami thought Harvey was bluffing, as many bullies do. He bought a ticket for the Amphar Gala and flew over to Cannes. Once there, he says, he received an email from a lawyer representing some of the Amphar board members telling him his ticket to the gala had been revoked. Ajami says he then got a notification from American Express telling him his payment for the Amphar Gala had been refunded. Kinney and Harvey did not want me there, he says. I was concerned that my warnings to Amphar were being suppressed and the charity was being damaged. For a moment, I considered forcing my way into the event to sound the alarm, a la Michael Moore. Just show up and see what happens, he continues. But in the end, he decided not to go, and wrote Frost to tell him not to worry. He would not disrupt the Khan Gala with his presence. At the gala, Weinstein announced that he was donating $1 million to Amphar, even though Ajami still refused to sign. The audience had no way of knowing his generosity was related to the signing of his controversial NDA. Last September, 4 months later, when he was still talking to the press, Weinstein told the New York Times about his Amphar pledge amid the brewing controversy about what he had persuaded Amphar to do. I went to them. I said, I'm paying you $600,000, though what he had promised was $1 million. Shut up. You're hurting the goddamn charity. The irony, of course, is that it is Harvey Weinstein who has hurt Amphar more than anyone could have possibly imagined. Paris was a ball. For the 25th annual Bal de Debutants, billed as the most prestigious coming-out party in the world, the cream of the 1% crop descended on Paris, trailing couture gowns, custom jewels, and chevalier. For the daughters of American movie stars, billionaire tycoons, and European royals, as Bob Colicello reports, it was a night to waltz with their dads, then kick up their Louboutin heels. Photographs by Jonathan Becker. The opening photo is a group shot featuring Amina Martinez of Irujo and Casanova in Zuhair Murad Couture, Wynton Harvey, Princess Garavi Kumari of Jaipur and Tarun Thailani, William Webster, Lucien Mal, Eva Philippe in Giambattista Valli Haute Couture, Paris McCaw in Oscar de la Renta, Giacomo Belmondo, Laurie Harvey in Elie Saab Haute Couture, Charlotte Bell in Monique Louvier, Ahan Pandey, Louis Martinez of Irujo and Casanova, Lily Webster in Alexis Mabil Haute Couture, Leila Blavatnik in Ralph and Russo Couture, Cecily Lasney in Chanel Haute Couture, Alice Ho in Christian Dior Haute Couture, Princess Costanza Pallavicini in Valentino, Ananya Pandey in Gaucher, Paris, Jean Mal in Vivian Westwood, H.H. Maharaja Sawai Padmana Singh of Jaipur, all jewelry by Payal, New York. One of the more amusing sights at the 25th edition of the annual Bal des Debutants held in Paris on Thanksgiving weekend was the Friday afternoon lineup of the girls' fathers, waiting to practice the box step with their daughters for what would be the opening waltz of the ball the following night. There in a row were the American comedian and TV host Steve Harvey, the Ukrainian-born British-American billionaire Lynn Blavatnik, the French perfume magnate Frédéric Malle, an Italian prince, a Spanish grandee, and a Luxembourgian royal. Call it diversity and inclusiveness global elite style. Or, as Le Bal's founder and CEO Ophélie Renoir sees it, the democratization of the rigidly exclusive and largely anachronistic presentations of high-born 18-year-old girls at European royal courts and American coming-out parties. No, not out of the closet, but into the adult ranks of the upper crust of their city, state, or region. I think it's silly to talk about coming out in society in the time of Facebook and Instagram, Renoir explains. There's not much difference at a certain level between girls from America, Asia, and Europe. They go to the same universities, listen to the same music, dress the same, the top ones. Contrary to what some believe, families do not pay Renoir to have their daughters invited to Le Bal. But they are encouraged to write checks to two charities, the Seleni Institute, a New York emotional health organization for adolescent women, and Enfant d'Asie, which promotes education for girls in Southeast Asia. Next photos, Laurie Harvey with her brother Wynton, Cecily Lasney, Ophélie Renoir and Reese Witherspoon, Eva Philippe, Leila Blavatnik with her father Lynn, Jean Mal with her father Frédéric. This year's crop of 21 Debs hailed from a dozen countries, including Japan, India, and Brazil. The most prominent among the half-dozen Americans was Eva Philippe, the daughter of movie stars Reese Witherspoon and Ryan Philippe. "I like the idea of doing something that's fancy and fun, but supports a good cause," Eva told me as she posed Friday afternoon for a fleet of photographers from Hello, Paris Match, and assorted international editions of Vogue. Eva was wearing, or rather it was wearing her, a shimmery gold gown with a giant birdcage skirt by Giambattista Valli. Each girl was dressed by a different couture house, among them Valentino, Dior, Chanel, Ailey Saab, Vivienne Westwood, and Armani Privé. Their hair and makeup were done by Alexandre de Paris and MAC Cosmetics, respectively. Their not-too-high heels were from Christian Louboutin, Le Bal's official shoemaker. Le Bal's official jeweler, Payel Mehta, told me that she consults with the debutantes on the design of the necklaces, earrings, and rings of dripping emeralds, sapphires, and colored diamonds she creates for each of them. Scotland's Cecily Lesnay, the daughter of model Stella Tennant and photographer-turned-osteopath David Lesnay, and a great-granddaughter of the Duke and Duchess of Devonshire, told Mehta that her family loves flowers, so we made her earrings with a large emerald set in the center of diamond petals. Perhaps not surprisingly, many parents end up buying these pieces of art converted into jewelry as presents for their daughters. Payel New York was also one of this year's sponsors of Le Bal, along with Group Renault and the Peninsula Hotel, the Grand 16th Arrondissement site of the ball. The girls also choose or are provided with the cavalier, as their equally young escorts are called. Eva Philippe was paired with the dashing H.H. Maharaja Sawai Padmanabh Singh of Jaipur, who, a few weeks earlier, had been competing with India's team at the World Polo Championship in Sydney, Australia, and whose sister, Princess Gauravi Kumari of Jaipur, was one of this year's Debs. Alice Ho, the daughter of Stanley Sun Ho, the so-called King of Macau, was matched with French film icon Jean-Paul Belmondo's grandson, Giacomo Belmondo. HRH Princess Charlotte of Nassau, daughter of TRH Prince Guillaume and Princess Sibylle of Luxembourg, brought along her twin brother, Prince Leopold, as did Spain's Amina Martinez of Irujo and Casanova. Amina and her twin, Luis, are grandchildren of the late Duchess of Alba. Royal and aristocratic girls with names such as Windsor, Romanov, Bourbon Parma, and Hohenlohe have always made up a large part of Le Bal's participants, and this year's roster included HRH Princess Natasha Derenberg from Belgium, HRH Princess Maria Francisca de Braganza from Portugal, Maria Pia of Young Dorlin and Braganza from Brazil, Princess Costanza Pallavicini from Rome, and Dona Jacinta de Marchesi Brivio Sforza from Milan. Previous balls have also included Debs with big political names, Lauren Bush, Kick and Kira Kennedy, Barbara Berlusconi, Xenia and Anastasia Gorbachev. This time, two of the Debs were from former U.S. diplomatic families. Los Angeles soap opera heiress Charlotte Bell's mother, Colleen, was President Obama's ambassador to Hungary. Seattle telecom heiress Paris McCaw's aunt, Susan McCaw, was President George W. Bush's ambassador to Austria. Bronwyn Carter, daughter of this magazine's editor, debuted at the 2012 Le Bal. "I think the parents are having more fun than the girls," noted HRH Princess Maria Teresa de Orleans and Braganza, whose daughter was wearing a gown by the Brazilian couturier Sandra Barros. "We are so proud." A joyous Emily Blavatnik never stopped taking photos of her daughter Layla with her iPhone. She had an additional reason to celebrate. Her husband, said to be the richest man in Britain, had just been knighted for his philanthropy by Prince Charles at Buckingham Palace. The newly minted Sir Leonard Blavatnik, however, decided to wear his Legion d'Honneur medal with his white tie and tails on Saturday night, because we're in Paris. The evening began with cocktails and hors d'oeuvres under the massive crystal chandelier in the peninsula's stately white marble lobby. Then, once all were seated at their assigned tables in the ballroom, came the main event, La Procession des Filles et Cavaliers. Master of ceremony Stéphane Bern, a veteran journalist and expert on royalty, declared Le Bal le plus prestigieux du monde. He then introduced each debutante in alphabetical order, listing her education, interest, dress, jewels, and escort, as he has done for the last 2 decades. "They are all so beautiful," sighed Marjorie Harvey, known for her blog, The Lady Loves Couture. After a classic French dinner of pâté de foie gras, medaillon de veau, and petit four, the action moved to an adjacent salon, where fathers and daughters danced their opening waltz to the theme song from La La Land. Disco dancing ensued, lasting until 3 a.m, and as Ophélie Renoir put it, another formative event in the education of debutantes came to its conclusion. Roe's rage. Harvey Weinstein may have been Rose McGowan's worst nightmare in 1997 when he allegedly raped her. 20 years later, she would become his, spearheading the onslaught of charges against the producer and channeling the white-hot fury of the hashtag MeToo movement. With the publication of her memoir, the actress tells of Jenia Peretz about the web of cruelty and complicity that she is determined to avenge. Photographs by Brigitte Lacombe. Turning the page, Rose McGowan photographed in New York City. Her memoir, Brave, comes out this month. I've had this giant monster strapped to me for 20 years, says Rose McGowan, her voice gripped with defiance. So many women have been strapped around him. He ate so many of our souls that he couldn't tell which way was which. He's always been gunning for me, but that's okay. I've been gunning for him, too. The open bathrobes, the locked doors, the pinning against walls and bending over desk, the grabbing, groping, and forced masturbation witnessing, the drumbeat of sexual assault claims has become as familiar as President Trump's tweets, giving rise to a disturbing question. Is our sense of shock becoming dulled? Amid the white noise, McGowan, who with her accusations against movie producer Harvey Weinstein started it all, has emerged as the movement's white-hot voice of rage, determined to ensure that the hashtag MeToo moment isn't just a passing fad. She's armed with a sizable Twitter following, literally called hashtag Rose Army, messianic certitude, and a sense of nothing to lose. Her memoir, Brave, out this month, isn't just about gunning for Weinstein. It's calling out all of them, she says, the whole ecosystem of Hollywood, the purveyors, the consumers, the media, the fans. Her argument is told via her personal story, which by any measure is extraordinary. Born in Italy into a cult called Children of God, which practiced free love and forced women into public flirting to attract followers, McGowan eventually fled with her family to America. Here, her parents having split up, she bounced between the homes of her psychologically cruel father and her mother, who continued to attach herself to abusive men. She did a stint in rehab, became a homeless runaway at age 13, and by 15 was living in Los Angeles, where she was taken in by a wealthy Beverly Hills kid who became her boyfriend, the first in a line of wolves in sheep's clothing. As she puts it, another cult awaited her, Hollywood. McGowan chronicles the many forms of abuse she has endured in her 20-plus years there, molestation by someone on set, exploitation at the hands of directors, complicity from agents and managers, demeaning critiques from the hair, makeup, and style departments, and bashing from the likes of blogger Perez Hilton. McGowan, it must be said, doesn't tread lightly in assigning blame, and at times her sense of martyrdom seems a bit over the top. For example, when she claims that having to shoot a wedding scene for the television show Charmed robbed me of the real experience, we performers sacrifice so much for your entertainment. Still, the facts surrounding McGowan's experiences are infuriating, their cumulative power chilling. Weinstein, whom she refers to only as the monster, allegedly raped her during the 1997 Sundance Film Festival, where Miramax was presenting Going All the Way, in which the actress starred. As she tells it, her presence had been requested by Weinstein in the top-floor suite of the Stein Erickson Lodge in Deer Valley, Utah. McGowan resisted, but she was told by a member of her management team that respect needed to be paid to the big man. McGowan has saved the hotel room details for the publication of her book. but she tells me that the incident looms as the B.C. and A.D. of her life. Part of you has been left behind, she says. You just got killed. After she left that room, she was bundled into a car and deposited on the red carpet. You still have the million-yard stare and don't know what the F just happened to you. The alleged assault and her agreement to keep quiet sowed the seeds for more destruction. In one of the memoir's most gripping chapters, she recounts her affair with director Robert Rodriguez, Spy Kids, From Dusk Till Dawn, a smooth-talking, sensitive-seeming guy who turned out to be a Svengali. He and Quentin Tarantino were planning a double feature, Planet Terror and Death Proof, based on pulp movies of the 1970s, and he wanted McGowan to star. McGowan fell hard and fast, trusting Rodriguez enough to tell him about her experience with Weinstein. He proceeded to use the knowledge against her, she claims, as a tool for mind games, starting with a scene in which Tarantino, playing a character in his movie, attacks McGowan's character. I was in a backward world, she writes. I was losing my grip on sanity. In what McGowan interpreted as the ultimate act of cruelty, Rodriguez sold our film to my monster. McGowan began writing Brave 3 years ago, not simply to tell her story, but to reform our thinking as part of an immense social re-engineering project. She believes she was put through these experiences to gather information. Even with Rodriguez, as brutal as it was all gathering data. Unfortunately, I am the data. It was a sacrifice. But I knew from a very early age that this messaging system was very, very wrong and needed to be brought down. As for Weinstein, he remains ever-present, seeing everything. No, this isn't paranoia. Among Weinstein's spies, reportedly hired to gather dirt on his potential accusers, was one Diana Philipp, who presented herself to McGowan as a women's activist and befriended her. It's a measure of McGowan's shrewdness that she was not all that surprised when she learned the woman was, in fact, a private investigator. I'm very open about whatever I actually think about the monster. Whomever I spoke to randomly, I knew it would get back to him. There were more mysterious incidents to come. Last January, on her way to the Women's March in Washington, McGowan walked off the airplane without her wallet. She says she began shaking, sensing something was amiss. The police contacted her, claiming that they had found two small bags of cocaine in it. She denies the drugs were hers and believes this was somehow the work of her nemesis. A hearing is scheduled for later this month. Whatever the truth, it has only emboldened McGowan. This fall, she embarked on what she says was a fake negotiation with Weinstein to settle for hush money, stalling for time, while she prepared to tell her story, eventually published in the New York Times and the New Yorker. They built an MFing beast, and they built an MFing problem, she says. I am that problem to all of them. He represents all of them to me, and that's why he must be slayed.
Thank you.
Now here's a Vanity Fair spotlight by Jim Kelly. Just You Wait. In the photo, My Fair Lady co-stars Norbert Leo Butts, Lauren Ambrose, Dame Diana Rigg, and Harry Hudden Patton with spectators, dressed up for Ascot, Melody Bates, Kate Morilli, and Matt Wall on the balcony, photographed at the Beckman Hotel in New York City. Photograph by Perry Dukovich. What kind of nutter would stage a revival of My Fair Lady, the Lerner and Lowe classic that made a Broadway star of Julie Andrews as the Cockney flower girl Eliza Doolittle? A peerless performance, matched in charm, if not in voice, by Audrey Hepburn in the gloriously glossy film. And who would be daft enough to muck with the memory of Rex Harrison, whose portrayal of the arrogant Professor Henry Higgins won him both a Tony and an Oscar? If Sir Rex didn't exactly teach the world to sing, he did teach it to talk on pitch. Director Bartlett Sher, who was also brilliantly insane enough in recent years to blow the dust off South Pacific and The King and I, is the daft nutter behind this latest revival. My Fair Lady is based on George Bernard Shaw's play Pygmalion, and the combination of Shaw's dialogue and Lerner's swift-moving adaptation and those songs, pick your favorite, I Could Have Danced All Night, or Wouldn't It Be Loverly, or Get Me to the Church on Time, or proved irresistible to share. Not to mention the sexual and class dynamics, no updating needed there. At play in Edwardian London, Cher's revival, which opens in March at Lincoln Center's Vivian Beaumont Theatre, features Lauren Ambrose, perhaps best known as Claire Fisher in HBO's 6 Feet Under, and Harry Hadden Patton, Bertie, who married Lady Edith on Downton Abbey as Professor Higgins. Two-time Tony winner Norbert Leo Butts, late of Netflix's Bloodline, plays Eliza's scheming dad, and Dame Diana Rigg, let's just say Emma Peel of the TV series The Avengers, and lament to ourselves that this is not a cover story, is Henry's mother. By George, she's still got it. Now, some offerings from the Vanity Fair agenda: advertising, promotion, events, and opportunities. Experience: 24th Annual Screen Actors Guild Awards on TNT and TBS. Every winter, more than 121,000 members of the Actors Union vote to decide the year's outstanding film and TV performances. Find out their choices right when they do during the 24th Annual SAG Awards on Sunday, January 21st, and share their surprise when a secret few of their peers disclose their personal take on the show's signature, "I am an actor." The fast-paced live ceremony, hosted by Kristen Bell at 8 p.m. Eastern Time on TNT, TBS, is the sole entertainment industry honors at which only actors take center stage. Tune in for the awards and stay for the warm elegance, the camaraderie, and the unexpected things, be they provocative, humorous, or heartfelt, that pop out of actors' mouths when they accept the actor statuette. Shop, just add diamonds. With a wide range of models already available, Swiss watchmaker Richard Mille Ladies Collection certainly allows any woman to find the right watch for her wrist. The new RM0701 automatic expands the options further and represents a new technical feat, the first time diamonds have been successfully set in ceramic. Separately produced and carefully polished to ensure a perfectly even feel, red gold prongs are embedded in the settings, receiving and holding fast the diamonds placed by the gem setter. Thus do the velvety black of the ceramic and the sparkle of diamonds set each other off spectacularly. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selections by Mark Hoffman.